This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm Kathleen Harris.
And over the past year or so, we've been talking and sharing various thoughts with you about how to approach your investments. I mean, that's what people do around this time of the year. You're probably filing your taxes, taking a look at your statements. How did you do last year? And we've talked about this idea about portfolio allocation and specific situations based on real life experiences with our clients and some of you, our listeners. One of the most popular programs that we've done over the last year was debunking the doomsday prepper portfolios. That aired in March of last year, pretty much close to where we are today. And we re-ran it again in September. Now, today's program is going to take that idea and look at it from another angle. Yes, there are serious things wrong with the U.S. deficit and spending. After all, we have $17.3 trillion in debt, and there are challenges in the economy. We still have a lot of unemployed workers. But as many of our NewsHour guests and I have discussed, there's still a lot that is going right for the U.S. economy. So we're going to ask you to consider again letting go of the financial meltdown mentality, which a lot of you have been locked into for 5 or 6 years. And we're going to ask you to rethink your visits to websites that constantly warn you, get out now, a crash is coming, pull your certificates out of the market, hide, bury your money in the sand. Whatever it is, they're always telling you that things are ready to crash. Think of that boy that cried wolf too many times. And that's what's happened over the last 5 or 6 years. The market hasn't crashed. It's corrected. There's been several. One more serious in the fall of 2011. You think back at that time, we had the crisis in Greece. U.S. debt was downgraded. And there was a fight in Washington over the deficit. But after that correction, the markets continued to go higher. And as we're speaking on this day, it's up over 175% from those March lows. And contrary to popular opinion, stocks are not cheap, but they're not ready to crash, and they're not overvalued. And the problem is, the doomsday people are always telling you the world is ending. Well, they've been telling you that 3 or 4 times every single year. And like a clock, eventually, at some point in the future, who knows, 3 years from now, 4 years from now, 5 years from now, they may be right again. So we're going to talk about this sort of get out, the crash is coming, and we want you to start looking seriously and divorcing yourself from that doomsday scenario.
You know, Jim, one of the gloomy predictions about the economy that people have been referencing a lot in some of these pieces that we know people have been reading has to do with the impact of the Affordable Care Act, lovingly known as Obamacare, on the economy, on employment, on benefits, on workers. So coming up later in the program, I know that you will be talking with Dr. Paul Howard from Manhattan Institute for Policy Research about this impact. Will the impact of Obamacare be enough to derail the economy? Now, we don't think so at this point. It's a little bit soon to tell. We do think there's going to be a measurable effect, but I know that you and Dr. Harold will be talking about that later on here in the program today.
Now, when we're talking about today's theme, divorcing the doom, one of the themes of our client meeting, which we did last fall, the theme was there's more right than wrong with the U.S. Now, let me get this out there. This doesn't mean that everything's rosy. And I suppose if you're unemployed right now, that's probably what you're looking at the world. It doesn't look good right now. But if you look at the overall economy, that doesn't mean that things are doomy as well. And so what we're going to do is go over some of the positive economic data and a lot of positive things that are happening here. If you think about the last probably 3 decades, one of the terms that you always heard in the media was outsourcing. Companies were moving factories overseas. Well, one of the things that you're hearing about now, and you're going to be hearing about this constantly over the next decade, is reshoring or insourcing. And it's not just companies like Apple, General Electric, or Dow Chemical that are relocating factories here. It's foreign companies as well. It's Airbus. It's Toyota. It's BMW. It's Mercedes. It's BASF Chemicals out of Germany. So some of the major corporations in the world are relocating here with Robolution. As robotics gets rid of labor arbitrage, manufacturing is returning to the U.S., and who would have thought 5 years ago that U.S. oil production would be growing by over 3 million barrels a day? But it is, and it's still continuing to climb.
And Jim, I know that one of the other things we talked quite a bit about in our client meeting was about this idea of autonomies, about these gigantic, mostly U.S. corporations that really have a huge global footprint in terms of their employment, in terms of their size of assets and their earnings. I would think that that, too, would also be a positive indicator for what's happening in the U.S. economy. In other words, there's still a lot going right with the U.S. economy in terms of corporations, corporate growth, and employment. At least that's what I'm hearing from you with the people you've been talking to on the News Era program.
And still, what I want to get back to is many of you are, if you take a look at your portfolio, still in cash, and think about what you're getting on that cash. If you take the inflation rate, which is low, and you take your tax rate, you're falling further behind. Or many of you invested in gold and silver as that single, it's kind of like taking a pill. I'm looking for one investment, heavily invested in gold and silver. It's not unusual to see people that have 50, 60, 70% of their assets in one category. And you're always hearing these fear mongers talking about pulling your shares to get direct registration or paper certificates because everything has been going down. In fact, one of the people that constantly advises this has been doing it for more than 3 or 4 decades and has been wrong. So a lot of you are waiting for that complete financial collapse. We had one. It was from 2007 to 2008. So a lot of you are leery about bonds. Yes, interest rates are low. And there is high risk if you're going out and buying a 30-year bond. There's high risk for bond ETFs and bond mutual fund investors. But still, there's a place in a portfolio for a laddered short-term maturity bond portfolio for stability and income. It's what Warren Buffett does with Berkshire Hathaway. It's what most insurance companies do, and what a lot of pension plans of which you are participants in are doing with their own portfolios.
And Jim, I think it's really important for our listeners here to really understand. We understand this perspective of waiting for the next financial crash to happen because, you know, certainly everyone listening here has been through two almost back-to-back huge financial corrections and financial challenges. Let's not forget the savings and loan crisis in the 1980s. Yes, these financial crises do happen from time to time. However, so far they've been crises rather than collapses. And certainly right now, with all the information that we're reading from the LEIs and other indicators, the manufacturing data, it was definitely telling us that for the time being anyway, there's still reason to be invested, especially in the U.S. And there's still reason to keep supporting U.S. companies and the U.S. markets and the U.S. dollar. So from our perspective, from the time being, we don't really think that the economic collapse is imminent or a dollar collapse is imminent. Now, this doesn't mean you should be asleep at the wheel with your investments. This does mean that you still have to stay alert for straws in the wind about things that might be changing. But the reality is that you should really always be investing in what the market is actually doing, not in what you think the market should be doing. And I just want to highlight this with a couple that we met with recently, Raymond and Olivia Barnes. Now, they're a couple that sort of epitomize this thinking about waiting for the collapse to happen. Now, they're in their early 60s, Raymond 64. He's been a manufacturing sales rep for 30 years now. Olivia was a school administrator, and she went back to work after the kids left the house, so she doesn't have quite as long of a track record in the work industry as her husband does. But what happened was they did have a fairly sizable portfolio in 2007, 2008. Well, obviously, like many people, 2008 really spooked them out of the market. So they went to 100% to cash and sort of stayed there for a while. And at this point in time, Raymond and Olivia realized that they had really been asleep at the wheel with their investments. They really hadn't been paying attention to what was going on in the markets and the economy. So they started deciding to educate themselves. So they started going to various different websites, reading up on various different economic perspectives, market perspectives, and decided that they really fell in the camp of people who really felt strongly that hyperinflation was going to happen, that there was going to be another financial collapse, and that the dollar was going to eventually collapse as well. And so at that point in time, which was around 2010, after doing a couple years of research after the first market crash in 2008, they decided that they were going to put a heavy investment in their portfolios into gold because they were very committed to this idea of a financial collapse and hyperinflation. So they put their money mostly into gold in 2010. Now, everyone listening here that's got money in metals knows that metals had a huge run up in 2011, followed by an equally painful run down. And unfortunately, Raymond and Olivia participated in the run up. Not so fortunately, they didn't sell near the top. They kept holding the metal. They still have the metal, so they rolled the metals markets all the way back down to where they are today. Now, here's the challenge that sort of has been happening with them as a couple. Not only have they been making choices that have dramatically impacted the size of their portfolio, but the fact that they've been reading this very negative information about the U.S. markets and economy, about the imminence of doom, frankly, has really started to affect their relationship with each other. It's gotten to be very tense between the two of them because the situation that they thought was going to happen, the scenarios they thought were going to happen aren't happening. They're sort of ingesting this doom talk all the time. It's not making them very happy as a couple or as individuals. And it's really having an impact not only on their finances, but on their relationship as well. So they came to us to say, okay, we must be reading the economic tea leaves wrong. We must not be understanding something because everything we've been doing has not been right. And even though we know in our gut something's wrong with the U.S. economy and markets, we also know that what we've been doing hasn't been working. So please help us out. What should we be doing with our money at this point in time?
And one of the issues that was really affecting this particular couple is most of their assets were in cash and gold, which is typically your doomsday scenario. And when you think about it, they're inconsistent. Number one, if you had your money in cash and we have another financial collapse, what's that going to affect? It's going to affect the banking system, just as in 2008 when the government had to bail out all the major banks, the major brokerage firms, and put money into them to keep them afloat. So if you think there's a financial crash, the last place you'd want to have in cash. And by the way, in 2008, when the financial crisis hit, gold went down, not up. So one of their problems was their portfolio itself, cash and gold. They were getting nothing on cash. And unfortunately, where they got in the markets around $1,400, $1,500 gold, it was nice when it went up to $1,900. It wasn't as nice when it fell down to $1,200. And where it's at today is $1,300. So they were having a hard time trusting the market. And part of the problem is if you go to what I call bias verification, if you have a negative view and all you read or go to are negative sites, you're never going to change your point of view. You're not going to have a balance. And so one of the problems that they had is their investment choices had caused them to miss the recovery in the stock market. Not only that, exposed them to a major downturn in commodities, especially precious metals. So the problem is there is no true catalyst for a big recovery in metals on the horizon. We may get a bounce. The most likely catalyst would be strong economic growth. And that was one of the things that I tried to point out to them in their doomsday scenario. I pointed out, look, I was telling people to get into gold in 2001. But what was driving the gold market was not your Mad Max scenario, which is what you're reading. It was strong global economic growth, especially in the emerging world. It was good times that drove the price of gold up, not bad times. When the bad times hit in 2008, gold went down. And that really got them thinking, especially when I showed them on the charts, global economic growth charts along with gold. And then I showed them the financial crisis, what happened to gold. So the impact of investment choices on their portfolio means they need to work past full retirement age until age 70. Because number one, they needed to maximize their Social Security benefit because they just simply were not going to have enough assets to live the way they wanted. It would reduce the drain on retirement savings too, because they wouldn't have to draw down their assets over a longer period of time, and then it was going to allow them some time for adding to their retirement savings and allowing more time for those growth of assets.
Now, here's the reality is that because they didn't have enough money to retire at full retirement age at age 66, and that they were going to have to work until age 70, at least Raymond and for sure was going to have to work till 70. We also encouraged Olivia to keep working till 70 as well, just given the realities of their financial situation. What that means in terms of time frame to invest is that Raymond has 6 years left to save and invest, and Olivia has 8. What this means is that their time horizon combined with their risk tolerance is going to affect how we suggest they allocate their portfolios. Again, looking at someone who's got 20 years left to retirement is very different from looking at someone who's only got, 6 to 8 years left to retirement. So now when we were looking at their overall portfolio, we recommended that they reduce their gold allocation to only 5% of their portfolio. We went back and forth with them, and they just were not comfortable with 5%. They really wanted to keep more of their portfolio in precious metals. So we ended up with a 10% allocation in precious metals in their portfolio. Now, in terms of what happened with Raymond's portfolio, he was the one that tended to have a much higher risk tolerance than his wife. So their entire family's metals allocation ended up going into his portfolio, which meant that he was going to have a little bit less in terms of percentage allocated to stocks and bonds. Net net, we ended up giving him about 20% in laddered bonds, mostly for stability. Again, we felt like a laddered bond portfolio for him was a better option than cash, but still gave them a little bit of stability, which is what they were really interested in, as well as some growth. So for Raymond, precious metals, some laddered bonds, the remainder in some dividend paying stocks. Again, looking to provide him with some growth in his portfolio and also preparing an income stream for him for retirement. Now, since Olivia was a little bit further away from retirement, she's 8 years away, we put most of her portfolio into dividend paying stocks, again, for growth purposes and because, again, bond interest rates are low. So we felt that the allocation in her husband's portfolio was enough for them as a family. Now, here's the situation with Raymond and Olivia. Based on how much they save over the next 3 years and based on how much their portfolios hopefully grow over the next 3 years, we encourage them to do a revisitation of their allocation in 3 years so we could see where they were at that point and adjust their allocation accordingly. And again, I think this is something important for everyone out there is that you really need to keep track of what's happening with your portfolios, at least on a quarterly basis, but revisit your overall portfolio allocation strategy from time to time, roughly every 2 or 3 years, especially as you start hitting milestones with your investment goals. If you're getting 2 to 3 years away from your house purchase or 2 to 3 years away from retirement, or maybe you start out with 10 years away from retirement and then you hit 5 years away, then you hit 2 years away, at each one of those landmarks, you want to really revisit your overall allocation in your portfolio to make sure if it still makes sense given the remaining time horizon to that big financial goal mark that you're trying to reach.
When you're looking at your investment philosophy or what you're doing investment-wise, you need to be flexible and adaptable. And one of the worst things you want to do is be reactionary. In other words, making your investment decisions on emotion. A good example is we took a look at our own philosophy after the 2008 crisis, and we took a look at the world was much different. We were involved and looked at large intervention by governments, whether it was fiscal policy by the U.S. government or massive intervention in monetary policy with QE. It was a different kind of market. And we also had to take and recognize the position in energy and precious metals in light of the hard data that was coming in from various sources, and especially the emerging world. If the philosophy and approach you're using now is not working, you need to ask yourself a question. Why isn't it working? One, is it just bad timing? Like this couple, getting in, there was a run-up in precious metals when they got in the latter part of 2010. Unfortunately, that run-up did not last, and unfortunately for them, they did not reduce their position when it began to roll over. Is it the specific investments chosen? One of the mistakes made here with this couple is they over-allocated a lot of money to one investment. You never do that. You never put 40, 50% of your portfolio in precious metals. Now, if you listen to the premium channel, you know I've had some well-known guests from Dr. Mark Faber, Felix Zuloff, a Barron's Roundtable member, along with Mark. I've had gold fund managers, and not one of them has ever said, you should put all your money in precious metals. Mark Faber basically said, look, if you're really aggressive, young, maybe 20%. but people have put 40, 50, I've seen 70%. And then three, is the philosophy you're using still sound? My personal opinion is that despite all the negative realities of debt, spending, and even the market, despite all these things, and if you think of all the events over the last 5 years, the market has run up. The financial system is not about to collapse. You're better off to position your portfolio for what is reality rather than for what may or may not happen, and then watch for signs for change. Is the economy changing? Is the philosophy in government changing? Which is why I encourage listeners, for the time being, to divorce themselves from doom.
I think this is a really important point here, Jim, about being flexible. I think one of the problems that we are having with Raymond and Olivia is that they had reached a point where their commitment to this doom philosophy had reached almost the point of commitment that people have towards religion. So in some way, this doom thinking had almost become a religion for them, and they were very, very emotionally and obviously financially committed to this particular perspective on the markets and the economy. Now, you said something earlier, Jim, that I think was really, really critical for listeners to be aware of, which is your own bias when it comes to the markets and investing. And the thing that you said, Jim, was that to be careful of bias verification, which is where you only go to websites or read articles or believe information that already corroborates your existing perspective. One of the things that I like so much about the NewsHour program, Jim, I mean, not to be a brown noser, but one of the things I really like about the NewsHour program is that we often have people on the program whose perspectives we completely disagree with. And I think that's really critical because it prevents this bias verification. It gives us as a firm and as financial thinkers a chance to revisit our own biases. You know, is this person saying something that's valid? Do we need to look at our own perspective and say, is it time to look at the markets from a different perspective? Is it time to really rethink where we're coming from? So I think the important thing for investors is when it comes to this bias verification is to always keep yourself open to reinterpretation of your own position. Stay open to new data. Stay open to new information. Don't just discard something because it disagrees with your pre-existing beliefs. And stay open to changes in the markets and the economy. Again, just because what's happening isn't agreeing with what you think should be happening doesn't mean it isn't actually happening. So again, just being really sensitive as an investor to your own biases and making sure that you're staying open to a variety of perspectives, because there's going to come a time when it's time to change your position and change your philosophy because the underlying markets and economy will have changed so much. But again, these are things that require careful thought. But again, don't get so locked into one perspective, you're not open to a change of heart and a change of mind and a change of strategy.
Now, one of the straws in the wind that a lot of people have been talking about, it's been in the news, is the impact of Obamacare on business, which may affect the U.S. economy and recovery going forward. The size of the impact is still hard to quantify because it's too early in the game yet. We're finding out more and more as it proceeds. I'm going to be talking with Dr. Paul Howard of the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research, and we're going to be talking about some of the first victims of Obamacare coming up right after this. Well, Obamacare is certainly making the headlines, whether it's the website, secrecy, or companies losing their insurance or not being able to get their doctors. But it's affecting more than that. It's affecting companies and affecting retirees. Joining me on the program today is Dr. Paul Howard. He is a senior fellow and director of the Center for Medical Progress. You know, Dr. Howard, this whole plan is affecting a lot more people. As they once said, it was over 2,000 pages and you had to pass it to find out what's in it. The more we find out what's in it, the more it is impacting more Americans, from seniors who are getting retirement programs from companies that they retired from to young people that have to go out and shop for insurance. So let's talk about its many effects, because I know in our own case, we were fortunate as a business to renew our healthcare coverage for a year. It ends in October. But then they told us that they have no idea what the costs are going to be when it is renewed.
Right. And that was very fortunate. The administration allowed plans to renew what are essentially non-Obamacare compliant plans for 2014. I'm not sure they're going to allow them to do that again this year round. And those plans are going to come up for renewal right around the midterm elections, right? October, November of this year. So it could have a pretty substantial impact on congressional elections. Now, the bullet that you have to bite if you're a small business owner, depending on your size, medium or large size owner, is if you have to buy new insurance that's more compliant with Obamacare and therefore has more costs, more benefits, and it's going to be a more expensive package. Defenders of the law will argue that's a more valuable package and that there are ways that Obamacare is going to help control costs for businesses in the long term. But in the short term, I think you're looking at more regulatory headaches and more costs. We're not going to know what that bottom line is until we finally see those new premium estimates in the coming months.
In my own case, I'm in my 60s. I don't need pregnancy coverage for my wife and I. We're done with our child-rearing years, but yet I'm going to have to include that in the plan coverage for myself. Or, for example, I am not suffering from drug abuse. I don't need to pay for that, but I am going to be required for that. So all of that cost has to go into the policy somewhere. So the costs have got to go up.
Right, and it's a hidden tax. If the government was to say, you know what, we want everyone to have access to these services, we're going to pay them, we're going to have a direct tax on everyone to fund that, there will be an uproar. Instead, they're requiring plans to sell coverage that includes those riders, and that's a tax on the person who's buying it. It's a hidden tax, but it's a tax nonetheless.
Well, I know a lot of companies, in fact, there was a survey. We get an economic group that gives us information. They took three states, I think it was Tennessee, Ohio, and Florida, and they took a look at plan coverage for people of various ages, mainly young people, either a family of four or a male or a female age 27. And in each case, the deductibles were horrific. Not to mention the fact that the premiums were probably 100% or more of what that person would, let's say, find coverage for if they were to go and get a policy on their own without being compelled to do so. So this is just another instance because they do need young people to go in and pay more for insurance and get very little for it.
That's actually right. So if you're a young person, you have very little expected medical expenses, basically because of the requirements of the law called community rating, which limits the spread between what a younger person's going to pay and an older person's going to pay to 3-to-1. In some states like New York, you can't even go that far. It has to be 1-to-1. So younger people are supposed to underwrite costs for older people. And as you said, buy lots of types of coverage that they're not necessarily ever going to use anyway. So that's a poor deal for that population. Now, having said that, if you're already sick, if you're very low income, you're going to get a lot of subsidies from the government to offset those costs. But for the president to have said, as he did several years ago, that his plan would bring down insurance costs by $2,500 a year for family premiums, that's just not happening. You know, we're paying more money for health insurance. And again, you could argue this is a richer product, a richer benefit set, but it's not controlling costs for the people who are going to be directly exposed to them.
Well, there's another exposure too, and it's going to be interesting how this plays on the electoral front. And you're seeing this from companies like Time Warner or IBM, where they used to provide health insurance for retired employees. Now they've elected to drop that coverage. It was never guaranteed. And they're saying, you know what? Instead of that coverage, we're going to give you a check and you go out and try to find this. So if companies as big as IBM is doing it and Time Warner, what is that saying? Are companies basically saying, look, we see, like in my own case, I've been told that our coverage, they said, you know, expect you could see 40 to 60% increase in premiums because, as we just mentioned, I may have to cover in our policy things that we don't actually need. Isn't this the same conclusion that companies like IBM and Time Warner are coming to?
Well, IBM and Time Warner, there's a continuum of responses to the law and also, frankly, to rising healthcare costs in general. So some companies are turning to the retirees, early retirees, and saying, we're going to move you into a private exchange where you're going to buy insurance from a bunch of Medicare Advantage plans or Medicare options. That's one approach. Other companies are moving their current employees into private exchanges, a relatively small number now, but it's growing, where they're going to be competing or choosing from insurance options with a defined set of money. So the company will say to you, you here is the amount of money we would have spent on you this year. You can go and choose from these plan options we're making available on an exchange. And other companies, particularly smaller companies, mid-sized companies that can't afford to offer Obamacare-compliant coverage and think that they don't have to offer health insurance coverage to be competitive in labor markets, are just going to increase wages and then send those people to the public exchanges. Now, all this is variant based on especially how the public exchanges are perceived. So if they're perceived to be expensive products with very narrow networks, as we're hearing in a lot of places now, if you don't have access to the doctors or hospitals you want in the kinds of plans that are available on the Obamacare exchanges, you could see a backlash and employers would back away from that. But this is all a very fluid situation.
Now, I read someplace, I think it was the Wall Street Journal, that talked about a lot of small plans, especially with small businesses like ourselves, that 80 million people could possibly lose their health care coverage. Now, if all of this is going to take place and we come into the elections, all of a sudden we're going to find out. I mean, when people find that they're either one, I've seen story after story that their health care coverage has gone up tremendously, or two, they're not being able to keep their doctors, or three, they get booted out of their existing insurance plan because it's non-compliant. I mean, that is going to be a lot of angry voters. How are they going to handle this politically?
Well, the administration has been doing its best to handle it through administrative fiat, which is to just say they're altering the law to try and head off some of these headaches at the pass. They've already delayed the employer mandate twice, once to 2015 last year, and now 2016 for businesses with between 50 and 99 employees, so they won't have to carry Obamacare-compliant coverage, although whether or not they can still buy those old plans they had in the marketplace is a whole different question entirely. There's talk for the individuals who had their plans canceled of extending the waivers for those people for another 3 years. There's talk of doing a lot of other things to help make insurers solvent for any losses they may take, covering populations that might have been sicker than expected because young people are stepping out. The administration is doing everything it possibly can to rewrite the law on the fly to head off some of these problems. But some of them, as you pointed out, are just inevitable. If insurers, you know, are saying, look, these policies that we're not compliant, we can't offer them anymore because nobody's going to be buying them with the expectation that the employer mandate is going to cost them potentially thousands of dollars per employee if they're not purchasing Obamacare compliant coverage, it's really kind of a black box, both for the insurers and the companies. If the administration keeps saying we're delaying the mandate, what do insurers do? They don't know. What kind of product are they going to be required to offer? What kind of product are companies going to want to buy? It creates tremendous uncertainty and confusion, and for the president and for Democrats, coming at the worst possible time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people are wising up to this and can see through it. Like, if I give you an exemption to get me through the 2014 election, how, as a business, can I plan for that? Okay, I get a one-year exemption that takes me past the election, but then what happens in 2016?
Right. It's uncertainty piled on top of uncertainty, and uncertainty is not what you want to help make markets work and obviously to help employers make decisions about how many employees they're going to employ next year and what kind of hours they need to work. It's a tremendous question mark hanging over a lot of businesses, certainly a lot of individuals as well. I think that the challenge here, and I think the Republicans are finally starting to do this, is come up with their own comprehensive alternatives and say, you know, here's an option that is a replacement plan for Obamacare or fixes the biggest flaws in Obamacare, and this is how you need to go about it. You know, remember, this is a law passed under extraordinary circumstances in 2009 and 2010, and the House and the Senate never got a chance to reconcile the two bills. You said earlier, and you're correct, more than 2,000 pages of legislation, obviously lots of problems in those 2,000 pages, and it's just coming into effect now. People are finally realizing what's in the law and potentially what needs to be done to fix it.
Well, there was a recent article in a business magazine talking about essentially what's behind this. We do know that a lot of state governments, we're seeing this in Detroit and other cities that have filed for bankruptcy, have unfunded pension liabilities, but they also have unfunded health care liabilities. Now, under the recent article, they talked about a lot of these health care costs, or what is defined as OPEB.
Other post-employment benefits.
Yeah. Basically, what is going to happen here is we're going to transfer about $3 trillion of future funding costs for state and local employees' health care plans onto the federal government. But if the costs are shifted to the federal government, I mean, nothing's free. Somebody at the federal government, meaning us, the taxpayers, are going to have to pay for that.
Absolutely. You know, only a few municipalities right now, I think Detroit was one of them, have taken advantage of this so far, maybe it was Chicago as well, have taken advantage of this clause. They can actually, like any employer can, is say, we're going to cash you out and we're going to send you to the exchanges and you can buy your insurance there. The caveats there are, we don't know how the public employee unions are going to respond to this, because the deductibles on the exchange are typically going to be much more significant than what you're seeing with traditionally union-sponsored coverage. And the exchange themselves, if they're not seen as being effective effective and efficient in offering high-quality coverage, I think you'll see another revolt there. But certainly, you're absolutely correct that the structure of the law and a lot of communities facing these very high employment benefit prices could dump a lot of these costs onto federal taxpayers, and that just means the bill just gets shifted to someone else.
Now, in cases like many small businesses, and the president just granted another exemption or a waiver for companies with employees 50 to 100, but if you're an employer and you are in that category 50 to 100, you don't have any certainty in this. Just like I don't have any uncertainty with our health care plan. We got it extended for 1 year. It only went up 6%. But they've already told us, come October, don't be surprised if our premiums could go up 40 to 60%. So I will be forced as an employer to do what many employers are doing, whether it's IBM, Time Warner, or others. Basically, I'm going to have to come up with the dollar amount and give it to my employees, and they're going to have to go out to these exchanges, which are, number one, more expensive. Number two, the deductible is substantially higher than what we currently have in our existing plan. How can that not affect people when they walk into the voter booth? And is the administration concerned about that? Because this is hitting people in their pocketbooks. I mean, when it was first passed, it was built as this wonderful thing that was going to bring costs down. You're going to keep your doctor. You were going to keep your plan. Now we're finding you can't keep your doctor. You can't keep your plan. People are being dropped. And we're also finding out you didn't save $2,500. It's probably twice as expensive. You can't hide that.
No, you can't. I think the law was clearly seriously oversold and attacked a problem I think everybody had a lot of sympathy with, which is relatively small fraction of the population is uninsured and has serious medical conditions. Actually, most of the uninsured, the majority of the uninsured are in very good health. But for those people, you do want to give them another option. But instead of just attacking that problem head on, we went on to a full bore reworking of the entire small group and individual insurance markets, making them more expensive, adding many, many new regulations, many new taxes, many regulations. That's just adding cost, confusion, complexity to the system. At the end of the day, I think people want something that's going to be simpler, tackle the real problems of access and cost, but do it in a more rational way. And that's slowly but surely what we're inching towards as more people understand the state that healthcare is in today.
Do you think that maybe prior to the election that the president and the Democrats, and maybe there will be some kind of compromise? You mentioned the Republicans are working on a plan. Will this be resolved before the election, or is it going to take an election and a different makeup of Congress to change it?
Well, I think you're going to see a bumpy path ahead. Senators Warner and Begich, both Democrats from Virginia and Alaska, respectively, proposed something called copper plans that will be available on the exchanges. That would be plans that will be more affordable than current plans on offer there. So that's a little opening of the door to say, yes, there should be more choice and competition on the exchange in terms of options for consumers. A lot of other reforms could be put in there that might be more market-friendly, consumer-friendly, expanding access to health savings accounts and health savings account eligible plans, paring back a lot of those mandates that you and I talked about at the beginning of the interview on pregnancy and drug addiction services for people who don't need them, et cetera. That would bring costs down still further. I'm not expecting any major changes before the election because, frankly, the Republicans can't get anything through the Senate because it's controlled by the Democrats. And Democrats have very little incentive to make major overhauls to the law right before an election, which is basically by way of saying, you know, we messed up here, we really have to do a rewrite. If the Senate changes hands and if the Republicans hold the House, maybe there's room for compromise there the way we've seen in other administrations. If the Republicans can say, you know, this law will have been in place for 7 years by the time there's another presidential election, maybe we can try and get some consensus on fixes with the president that move us in a direction that we like, but that would still be acceptable to the president, who would obviously still have a veto power for the remainder of his administration. So I think maybe not before November, maybe after November, you could see some significant reforms to the law.
Leading up to November, if people are, number one, losing their policies, number two, they're not being able to see doctors. I've noticed it just here, and my employees have told me that it's taking a longer time now to get in to see a physician. So we're seeing that change here. Those are things that aren't going to change before the November election. Aren't they worried that this will have some kind of impact?
Right. For next year, what the administration is proposing to do is to ask plans to cover more doctors, cover more hospitals as a condition of participating in the exchanges. But that is obviously going to raise costs for plans and for taxpayers, frankly, because those plans that cover more hospitals and doctors are going to be more expensive. The Achilles heel here is that if you're going to require a very rich benefit set and limit deductibles and co-payments and max out-of-pocket costs for people who are buying these plans, the only thing that you can change is reimbursement to physicians and hospitals and the number of hospitals and physicians you have in network. So plans have very limited ability to tailor their options for people who are looking for more affordable coverage. And that's not going to change unless the administration gets under the hood of the law and says, you know what, we made this a little too inflexible. We need to go back and rethink our approach.
What are the chances that this actually happens? Because we're finding out more and more. I mean, you have to look at various places to find out this information, because a lot of the media has sort of buried this. I mean, you know, just even the fact that the website isn't working, the fact that there is no security there, and then the fact that we don't even know, even those that have signed up, who's actually paying. There's even talk, not in addition to just bailing out local governments and state governments and passing that on to the federal government and ultimately us, the taxpayers, but there's also talk about bailing out some of the insurance companies, because you and I know, doctor, that if, let's say we take an automobile insurance policy, if I'm an auto insurer and I have an applicant where I see he's gotten speeding tickets, he's run red lights, you know, he's had a DWI, I'm looking at him as a high risk. So I'm going to be able to price that risk into the policy if he wants insurance. If companies can't price that, how do they make money? In other words, if I have to take everybody and I can't make an adjustment for those who don't take care of themselves or poorer health care risk, doesn't that mess up the whole pricing mechanism of the marketplace?
It does. It makes it extraordinarily difficult. The only way you can compensate is by having lots of healthy people with low expected expenses in your insurance plan. Now, the wrinkle there is, as we've just talked about, healthy people see high price tags and they're not eligible for very significant subsidies. They're going to wind up paying more in out-of-pocket costs and premiums to buy coverage than they would just by going uninsured and paying the penalty under Obamacare to be uninsured. Now, for the first year, that's only $95 or 1% of income. You know, for somebody making $30,000 a year, that'll be $300 a year. So that's, at least for the first year of the law, it's a big incentive for young people who are very healthy to sit out the pool. And the insurers, Aetna, Cigna, others have already said, yes, this is a worse risk pool than we had anticipated. And the administration is, again, trying to compensate for that by offering insurers more financial protection from taxpayers to offset potential losses.
You know, this cannot have a good outcome, because one of the things that has affected, I think, this economic recovery has been all of the uncertainty that we've had over Washington, over the budget, the debt ceiling, government shutdowns. Now you interject another uncertainty, which is healthcare. You're talking about almost 16-17% of the U.S. economy.
Right. Although keep in mind, I mean, for very large self-insured employers, you know, the IBMs of the world, they make decisions at the margins. You're absolutely right that uncertainty, regulatory uncertainty, hangs over the economy, hangs over small business decisions in particular, if they don't know what their tax and regulatory environment is going to look like. So that, you know, spilling over across many different dimensions of the economy, not just healthcare, and obviously energy with things like the Keystone Pipeline, taxing decisions, you know, people want to know what their tax environment is going to look like for the next several years. All that's essentially up in the air. And taken together, all of that's going to have an impact. Any individual decision might be just at the margins, but taken together, all of that, I think you're right, does create substantial uncertainty for business investment climate.
If you had to, let's say, predict what the future might look like, and especially as we get into the fall, as we get closer to election, when a lot of these plans, like including our own, come due, and people start dealing with this, either one, they've lost their plan, number two, they can't keep their doctors, or number three, they find out that the coverage that they have to find to replace what they've lost is so much more expensive, including the premiums, not to mention the fact that the deductibles in many cases are twice as high.
Right. Here's my kind of short-term and longer-term prediction. I think in the short term, the administration is going to keep trying to make change the law through administrative fiat. They're going to strong-arm insurers to try and keep premiums down, to offer more hospitals and physicians in their networks, at least in 2015. And again, try and expand what's called the risk corridors or the taxpayer bailouts under the law to protect insurers from any losses they have from having a sicker risk pool. All that's going to continue to happen. In the long run, I think you're going to have pressure to open up the law after November and go back and get some serious fixes, if if not replace the law entirely, as people recognize that the fundamental problems about cost haven't been addressed, still significant problems with coverage. And insofar as we can tell right now, a lot of people who are getting coverage on the exchange and even getting subsidies are not people who were previously insured. They're people who are just switching over from individual coverage that was canceled. So those concerns about the law, and as more evidence develops that people are, you know, facing substantial headaches and financial costs because of the law, is going to force Washington to rethink its approach after November, I think, if not before that.
Doctor, what should those that are listening to this kind of program that are either retired, aren't being able to keep their doctors, or they've lost their plans, what should they be doing?
The best thing you can always do is write to your congressman or woman and complain. That's the reality of Congress, is that the squeaky wheel gets the grease. So that, I think, is actually important. And also talking to your providers and making sure that they're being in contact with their representatives as well and communicating their concerns to them. For business people, the bottom line of the day is, you know, they are the job creators, they're the innovators, they're the entrepreneurs that keep the economy humming and moving along, and their voices carry weight in Washington. So if they find ways to speak together with one voice and make their concerns heard, I think they can have an impact on the administration. You've already seen that twice now with the delay of the employer mandate. I think that attention should also be paid to the individual market and what's happening there.
Doctor, are there any sites where our listeners can go to become more informed about this process? Because you almost have to become like an investigative reporter. I mean, there are publications like the Wall Street Journal where you can get some information, Business Insider that talks about this, but you have to hunt for it because the mainstream media has almost been mum on this.
Right. You know, other good places to go, Investors Business Daily is a terrific resource on many of these matters. You can come to our website, manhattan-institute.org. There's also the Forbes Apothecary blog, where I write and my colleague Ulrich Roy writes about healthcare policy and healthcare-related issues. That's a great resource as well. And then there are terrific think tanks, not just us, but places like the American Enterprise Institute and others down in D.C. who do great work on healthcare as well. So there are lots of great places to go out there. And then there are people who are really working on the front lines to try and bring new policy options to the table. The Republican Senators Burr, Hatch, and Coburn produced a comprehensive health care reform bill a few weeks ago that's well worth considering and taking a look at. Paul Ryan, the House, are looking at other things. And again, Senators Warner and Begich on the Democratic side are producing their own templates for reforming the law. So I think there are things out there that are percolating just beneath the surface. You don't tend to notice them because of all the partisan wrangling in D.C., but there are some positive shoots out there.
Well, listen, Doctor, I want to thank you for coming on the program. Keep up the good work. And, you know, I think it was Winston Churchill that once said about America that they'll try all the wrong things first before they finally figure it out. Maybe that's what's going to happen here.
I think there's never more true spoken words than in the case of healthcare.
All right, Doctor, thanks so much for joining us on the program.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thanks. Take care.
That concludes this week's Lifetime Income. Once again, we're finding out more and more issues relating to Obamacare. And one of the reasons we bring this up is because when you take a look at retirement planning, and especially when you get into your later years, healthcare costs are one area that are not often planned upon. People get supplemental insurance, but as we know, as we age, if we become ill, those costs can be quite substantial. So we'll be covering more about this and try to help you navigate through this as we find out more and more just exactly what is in this law. And as the law itself evolves, it seems like almost every single month. On behalf of Kathleen Harris and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.